Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot on health and healing. We're going to talk about a component in green tea can help reduce prostate cancer risk in men. Also, how watercress, delicious-tasting vegetable, can kill cancer cells and offer very strong cancer protection. Also, we're going to look in depth at the health power of coconuts, a special edition from Life Extension, and we're going to look at the 12 most common birth control side effects from the pill. Now, I'm not telling people to use or not use birth control. We should use birth control if we want to be responsible, and if we want a pregnancy, it should be a planned pregnancy, not an unplanned pregnancy. But to stop there and to assume that there's no risk is wrong. There are a lot of risks, and therefore the safest possible birth control should be used. And men could do a lot on that level as well. Also, the Western diet may increase your risk of death from prostate cancer diagnosis. Harvard University School of Public Health will look at that. And also, scientists discover a link between common medications and serious falls in older men from Trinity College Dublin. So we have a lot on health and healing, as we do every day. Then we're going to look at a lot of issues today. For example, because we have all been betrayed by those legislators and the president and his cabinet and the top people in the State Department and so many different people who will benefit from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, I'll talk about, yes, trade deals really do destroy democracies. David Morris on the Commons, and why it's bad to the bone. You've heard me say that if this passes and becomes law, it will destroy our nation. It will. Now, the guest in the second part of our program, providing we're able to get a good Skype connection from Yorkshire, United Kingdom, is Professor Brad Evans. He is the senior professor, University of Bristol School of Sociology, Politics, and International Studies in the United Kingdom. He's also the founding director of the Histories of Violence Project, which researchers say is the best of the best in the role of violence in its many manifestations upon society and culture. So what are we going to talk about? How violence seduces us and makes our lives and future disposable. Yesterday, I landed at my destination in preparation for what I'm sure will be a remarkable retreat for people. And while in the airport, they had this program on, and I was watching these athletes compete in some extraordinarily hazardous athletic event. And I'm thinking, okay, this is today. We'll bore of this. And then instead of falling into water pools, they'll fall into water pools with anaconda or alligators or crocodiles or piranha, because our appetite for violence is increasing, becoming more and more extreme. We no longer have boxing. We have, you know, bear boxing, kicking, anything you can do to hurt another person, cause submission. These are very popular. I want to see his perspective on this. Also today, from our environmental segment, the leading climate scientist in the world, Professor Hansen, who we've had on this program, he's saying this, quote, "A future is bleaker than anyone thought." All right. And then this is from the New Scientist. So when I said, remember, go back 7 years, almost 8 years now, I said, after interviewing for one of my films, the actual real person that Jeff Goldblum character was kind of designed around for Jurassic Park, the chaos theorist, this is the real guy. And I said to him, can anyone accurately predict what's going to happen? He said, no. Now, why? Because we no longer have a slow, linear progression where we could say, well, if you live at the ocean, you won't have a problem in your lifetime or the next person's lifetime, but maybe in 200 years. Now we're seeing every single day, for the first time in all of our lives, things that were remarkable. For example, today, as we speak, Iran and Iraq will have their hottest days on record, over 122 degrees, and that's not the heat when it collects in rocks and sands and then projects out. That is merely pure temperature, so it could go much higher. Also, we have snowing in different parts of the United States today. How in the world can you have snow? But we do in three different areas, Colorado, for example, up in Wyoming. And we have one of the worst typhoons. We have El Nino, serious, gigantic waves. So it's all happening. It would be an extraordinarily irresponsible position to say it doesn't matter, I'm protected, there's no consequence. There's going to be a lot of consequence, so we're going to deal with that. And also, if time permits, I'm going to share a few things about our economy and how, yes, one group of people are recovering nicely and making a lot of money, causing a housing market boom in some places in the United States, and that's what the media pays attention to. But what about for everyone else? I'll share their side of the story. So you see, we have a lot to share today. Let's get into it. Most people never eat watercress. You generally don't find it year-round. I used to grow watercress. I had a stream behind my farm, upstate New York, for 15 years, and I would plant the watercress, and you go out in the springtime, and it comes up about 10, 12 inches, and you pick off the leaves, you don't eat the stems, and you make a wonderful salad. It's extraordinarily pungent, but it's extraordinarily healing. This is just the latest, and this is from the World Cancer Research Fund, major group from Natural News. Quote, a wealth of scientific evidence, plus no shortage of real-life observations, make it difficult to dispute the critical role that nutrition plays in overall health, and more specifically, the human body's ability to ward off cancer. In fact, it is estimated that up to 40% of all cancers are directly linked to poor diet. For example, cruciferous vegetables, such as broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage, are prized for their anti-cancer properties. While vegetables like broccoli, cauliflower, and cabbage are commonly used, it is the lesser-known watercress that exhibits some of the most beneficial qualities for preventing and slowing the growth of cancer. Now, I finished last year a book and a documentary on cancer, and in it I looked at all the proven scientific evidence, peer-reviewed journals, that showed that there was some benefit. And needless to say, some benefit means you don't have a single item that's going to make an enormous difference, but you have multiple items brought together in a juice or a salad or supplements can make a difference. And what we found is you can reverse, in many cases, providing you're following the right protocol under the right direction, you can help reverse cancer naturally. And so one of the things that we could start to do is put more cruciferous vegetables into our diet and more antioxidants at the same time. The two work together synergistically. Vitamins A, C, E, K. By the way, vitamin K is critical to bone health. In addition, have your vegetables like watercress. Why? Because you've got a high degree of lutein, L-U-T-E-I-N. This is a carotenoid, and it's got great ability to protect cardiovascular health and safeguard vision. It also protects your DNA from the kind of damage associated with the development of cancer. So if you want to have healthier DNA, have more vitamin C, more A, more E, more vitamin D, and of course your cruciferous vegetables. And there's they've shown in the laboratory that watercress can kill cancer cells. It has no damaging effect at all. The University of Ulster published what many consider the most convincing work to date regarding watercress and its ability to slow the progression of specific biomarkers that are known to be associated with cancer risk. In the study, 60 men and women, with half of them smokers, were given 3 ounces of raw watercress daily as part of a normal diet for 8 weeks. And researchers then took a look at the DNA effects of lymphocytes and plasma lutein, retinol, alpha-tocopherol, and beta-carotene. And overall, there was a 17% decrease in the basal DNA damage. Meanwhile, antioxidant blood levels rose by 33% and lutein by 100%. Interesting, smokers gained even more from the DNA protective aspects of watercress than in the non-smokers. So there's good science, there's good evidence that just use watercress, probably best in your salads. Now, another thing that protects us against cancer is green tea. There are over 5,000 studies in the peer-reviewed literature on green tea. Now, again, I might mention a nutrient, but I might mention 10 different nutrients, all that have shown different anti-cancer benefits. So the idea would be, if you can, use all 10. But if not, at least use what you can afford to find. Green tea is not expensive. It's used in India, China, the Philippines, Korea. So over 1 billion people use it. And here's the latest from the Moffitt Cancer Center. And major look at what green tea does. Here's what they say. Quote, prostate cancer is the second most common type of cancer in men and is predicted to result in an estimated 220,000 cases this year in the United States. In recent years, an emphasis has been placed upon chemo prevention, the use of agents to prevent the development of or progression of prostate cancer. A team of researchers led by Dr. Kumar at the Moffitt Cancer Center recently published results of a randomized trial that assessed the safety and efficacy of active components in green tea to prevent prostate cancer development in men who have premalignant lesions. And they found that the green tea, quote, laboratory studies have shown that substances in Greek called catechins, these inhibit cancer cells, their growth, their motility and invasion, and stimulate cancer cell death. So green tea catechins also prevent and reduce tumor growth in animal models. And it's called the EGCG. That's the most vibrant of the potent catechins found in green tea, responsible for cancer growth. And here they found that compared to those men who received the placebo and treated for 1 year, there was a substantial difference in prostate inflammation and prostate cancer. So the takeaway message is this. If you use green tea, either as a tea or its active components, you're reducing your risk of prostate cancer, and that's important. There is a simple food that's been used for thousands of years. It's the coconut. And coconuts are very healthy. Yes, they have saturated fat, but it is my opinion that the people attacking saturated fats lack an understanding of nutritional biochemistry, because we need a certain amount of saturated fats. Coconuts have that. The coconut, the Cocos nucifera, has been known for a long time as one of the perfect foods. And in fact, in India, it's called the all-giving tree. You get the coconut wood, the leaves, the sap, and especially the fruit. And that's how they've used it. And by the way, the sap of the coconut tree is the source of the low-glycemic coconut syrup or coconut sugar, which is much better than the other sugars out there. And the fruit of the coconut palm is valued for its water, which is rich in potassium, and its flesh. And in fact, they're now using that to make coconut cream, coconut milk, coconut flour, coconut oil. And why? Well, let's just take a moment and look here. First, it's very rich in minerals. The coconut water is becoming more popular. And why? Because if you just drink coconut water, and now there's the raw water that you can buy in the bottles that has not been processed, just straight out of the coconuts, it gives you more potassium than almost any other food you could consume, including the banana. And for athletes, that's tremendously important that you have your electrolytes and your potassium, especially when exercising in hot weather. I always recommend if you're going out in the sun and exercising, make sure that before you go out, you have beet juice and coconut water, equal amounts, to hydrate yourself, but also give yourself the potassium. In one model of diabetes, coconut water lowered oxidative stress and reduced blood sugar levels. But although coconut does contain a high percentage of saturated fat, the majority is in the form of the beneficial medium-chain triglycerides. And there is evidence that the medium-chain triglycerides increase the burning of calories, thereby aiding to weight loss. There was a randomized trial involving women between the ages of 20 and 40, and one to determine what the coconut oil would do for their waist circumference, and also would it help their HDL, or the good cholesterol. A study conducted in the Philippines found an association between increasing coconut intake and greater levels of the high-density lipoprotein. That's the good protein, or excuse me, the good cholesterol, while showing no effects on the bad LDL. Now, another study of residents from West Sumatra, Indonesia, who consume a large amount of coconut, concluded that the fat from coconut was important overall in their diet. And coconut oil is also a treasured non-toxic treatment for hair and skin. If you want something to really help your skin at night, in Italy they use olive oil. And I agree with that. You take about 2 tablespoons of coconut oil, put it in your hand, massage your hands, and massage that into your scalp and your hair, and leave it on overnight. If you don't have any place you have to go the next day where you have to groom yourself, then leave it on, ideally 3 days, then shampoo it off. You can do the same thing with coconut oil, except you can use coconut oil over your whole body. And also, coconut oil has what is called monolaurin, mono, M-O-N-O, laurin, L-A-U-R-I-N-N. It's a derivative of lauric acid found in coconuts. It has very strong antibacterial effects against a number of organisms responsible for skin infections, including Staphylococcus aureus. Now, when I was working at the Tri-State Healing Center, I had 1,200 people with AIDS, defining illnesses. Remember, AIDS is not one condition, it's a full spectrum of conditions. And 2 of those conditions involve the skin. And so I suggested that they drink a quart of coconut water a day, but also to take the coconut oil and massage it into the lesions. And you would have people after 4 to 6 weeks saying, my lesions, the oozing around them, they're drying up, they're falling off. So coconut oil is extremely beneficial. Also, fructose, another study, if we needed another, this is in the University of Illinois, shows it contributes to weight gain, physical inactivity, and body fat. Well, we knew it was bad, and we've known we've had fructose for 40 years hidden in the American diet. It's the one thing you should look at and say no to on a label. In this latest paper, published in the peer-reviewed journal Scientific Papers, entitled Fructose Decreases Physical Activity and Increases Body Fat Without Affecting Hippocampal Neurogenesis and Learning Relative to the Isocaloric Glucose Diet. In lay language, when people took in fructose, more often than not in soft drinks, you become lethargic because it plays havoc with your blood sugar, shooting it up, shooting it down. And then it has an activity on the mitochondria. So just stay away from it. And finally, on the subject of birth control, I believe that men should be as equally responsible as women. If it means that wearing a condom, then wear a condom. Absolutely. Also to protect yourself. But if your partner knew do not want to have a child, then if you just suggest that birth control pill, understand that there's a lot of negative that comes with it. The oral contraceptive pill is a hormonal contraception, and about 12 million American women are currently using it. And in fact, about 8% of women experiencing unintended pregnancy were taking the birth control pill, so it's not 100% effective. By this measure, it's a low 90% effective. But there's all kinds of problems that can come. The moment you're messing with the body's hormones, and especially the estrogen-progesterone balance, then you got some problems. What are the problems? Here are what are common. These are not extraordinary or exceptional. Regulation of the menstrual periods, irregular periods, menorrhea, which means a heavy period, dysmenorrhea, which means a painful period, endometriosis, premenstrual syndrome and premenstrual dysphoric disorder, acne, excess hair, alopecia, which is hair loss. So these are things that you have to be aware of. And for example, a lot of women using the pill end up with intermenstrual spotting. Vaginal bleeding between your expected periods is experienced by approximately 50% of women using the pill, most commonly within the first 3 months initiating the pill. And nausea, mild nausea is common, breast tenderness, headaches, weight gain, mood changes, missing periods, that's right, take the pill, you can miss your periods. And several factors can influence this, such as outside stress, illness, travel, or at times hormonal and thyroid abnormalities. But if you're on the pill, that's exacerbated. And here's the most interesting thing for a lot. Decreased libido. The pill can affect your sex drive. In effect, it can bring down your sex drive. Also, vaginal discharge, and which is very common in women using the pill, and vaginal changes with contact. So all those are things you should consider, and then look for the natural and non-toxic alternatives. I'm Gary Nall. We're going to take a break and come back and share some things about our Trans-Pacific Partnership that we shouldn't have. And also, Dr. Hansen has some thoughts about how bad it's going to be, and people don't want to hear this, but we should. Please stay with us. Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Nall. I'd like to say hello to all the people listening from stations in Utah, Wyoming, Colorado, Florida, West Virginia, New Hampshire, all over America. We thank you for providing your listeners with our program. And we, anytime that we can answer the questions from people in the audience, let us know. Because we're going to be going back next week to answering people's questions every day on the air. If for any reason people cannot find us on the dial for some reason, maybe they're traveling, you can always at noon Eastern Standard Time each day call a phone number, any phone device you have, and you can listen live. Let me give you that number. Please keep it with you. It is 712-432-7900. 712-432-7231. 712-432-7231. And of the 5,000 radio outlets in the United States using it, we have the most by a big margin. So overall, approaching 20 million minutes listen. Whoa, a lot of people listening. And a lot of those are cab drivers in New York City. So a special hello to the cab drivers. And because a lot of those cab drivers are from Haiti, I want to let you know that next week we are having a program on Haiti and how billions of dollars is raised to help the Haitian people, and it doesn't never gets to the people. Where's it go? Well, it goes to the NGOs and other foundations by famous people, never gets to the people. Well, how can this happen? Well, we're going to take examples. We're going to do a specific examples of different foundations and different charities like the Red Cross. They got $500 million to build 120,000 homes. They built six. Not 60,000. Six. Well, how's that possible? Well, it's possible if you know there's no accountability. You take the money from people in a crisis and you spend it on whatever you want to. I want to talk now about climate change. I want to share a few thoughts from The New Scientist. Mind you, this is a major publication. I'm going to quote it verbatim. Quote, leading climate scientist states, the future is bleaker than we thought. Highly speculative, full of conjecture, based upon flimsy evidence, not supported by mainstream science, not peer-reviewed, not suitable for basing policy on. That sounds like climate scientists are talking about the claims of climate deniers. But this time they are talking about a July 23rd discussion paper by James Hansen, the most famous and respected climate scientist on the planet. In it, Dr. Hansen starts by arguing that the ice melting on and around Greenland and Antarctica will cause rises in sea levels that are much faster than mainstream predictions, meaning that we are likely to see several meters of sea level rise. This is an argument that he's been making for a long time. For instance, in his 27,000 feature for New Scientist. Even more startling are the consequences that Hansen thinks will result from this rapid melt. Because fresh water is less dense than salt water, the cold, fresh meltwater will pool around the coast of Greenland and Antarctica. Well, this means you're going to have a blanket of water. Around Antarctica, this surface layer will act as a blanket, floating on top of warmer, saltier water and preventing it from losing heat in the air. Instead, this heat will go into melting the underside of ice shelves and glaciers. Hansen argues that the growth in sea ice around Antarctica is a sign that this is starting to happen already, with freshening surface water forming sea ice more readily. This freshwater layer will also shut down the ocean currents that carry heat from the tropics to the poles, so the tropics will warm fast while high altitudes cool down because of the cold surface waters. This resulting temperature difference, Hansen claims, will power superstorms of a size and fury unlike anything ever seen in history. Such superstorms occurred towards the end of the last interglacial period, 120,000 years ago. The paper claims it details several lines of evidence suggesting that the islands of the Bahamas were frequently pounded by massive waves at that time. For instance, there are wave-formed ridges many kilometers long on the islands and wave deposits up to 40 meters above the current sea level, including massive boulders weighing thousands of tons. Most terrifying of all, Hansen thinks all of this could happen with just a 2 degrees centigrade rise in temperature. 2. We've already passed 1. Now, I'm talking now, I'm not from the paper. Back to the paper. Quote, the consequences would be catastrophic. Quote, it is difficult to imagine that conflicts arising from forced migrations and economic collapse might make the planet ungovernable, threatening the fabric of civilization. End quote. That's what his paper says. So, to give you an idea, there was a tsunami that was 600 feet high 300 years ago. And that tsunami came from an earthquake that is now going to be happening again in the same identical area. And they estimated it at 9.3. Phenomenal. And yet, there is nothing being done. There's no discussion of this within the main media. So, one of the reasons I suggest, in an appropriate but in a focused and timely way, people should be examining where they're living, how they're making their income, and whether or not they should be looking to live in more sustainable areas, less likely to be adversely affected by climate change conditions or extreme weather events, and also the quality of your water and soil. Recently, and you'll see a lot of this in my new film, you'll see places that were once very rich in their topsoil, bountiful in the vegetables or the grains they grew, and today they're just dust bowls. As far as you can see, driving hours at a time. So I'm concerned that as a country, the United States and its citizens have not made the consequences of global warming or environmental challenges a higher priority. That doesn't mean everyone is doing that. There are people who are conscious, who are moving. For example, people are looking at where are there safe places to live, where are there progressive communities, and good for them. You're on the right side of history. Because once you have a major environmental crisis, you can't stop it. It'll create a feedback loop. So once one of those giant sections of Antarctica or Greenland fall, calve, break and come off in the water, the one behind it is going to cascade it and cascade it and cascade it. And then in no time at all, you could have ocean risings, which in and of themselves, you say, well, so what? So the ocean rises 10 feet. Who cares? Well, just imagine what that would do to the subway system down when the first tropical storm came. Not even a Category 1, just a severe tropical storm. You would flood the entire downtown system. Now, what if you had a Category 1, 2, or 3? Category 3, you're going to knock out New York City for months, the entire downtown section. Remember, Category 1, look what the last one did to us, and that was just a Category 1, small. You wouldn't have known that based upon how many people suffered. Let us pay attention to the likely outcome and make our choices based upon that. I'm Gary Knoll. Just want to deal one more issue before we go to our guest who's standing by in the United Kingdom. And that is, as you know, I'm opposed to all of the current treaties we have enforced plus those that are projected. I'm opposed to NAFTA. Look at the consequences of NAFTA and GATT and the World Trade Organization. All of those pale by comparison to the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Once that happens, it's all about secret meetings of some 600 lobbyists representing major industries. And if anyone had any doubt, if anyone in the major media cared, they would ask the President of the United States, if this is supposed to benefit the American public, why is it all secret? Why are there sections that are you have to sign that you cannot even make a note on it? You cannot report on it. You cannot discuss it. What kind of democracy is that? And you're a constitutional lawyer. You know, whose interest is this being done in? Why don't you invite members of the public, the media, the legislature, to examine the contents and see what's it about? Nope, nothing. And as Nancy Pelosi said, you know, we'll know what's in the law once we pass it and read it. That's what we've come to. Well, this is from On the Commons, David Morris. It's about, quote, forget tariffs, forget Obama's promises. The whole point of modern trade agreements is to whack pesky labor, environmental, and health laws, and so empower capital and corporate power against regulators, governments, and democracy itself. Unconvinced, just imagine what these deals would look like if they were there to empower people. New trade agreements, like the Trans-Pacific Partnership, largely comprise a laundry list of corporate aspirations. To understand its bias, imagine, what if a trade agreement were designed to protect and nurture labor rather than capital? What if a trade agreement were designed to protect and nurture people? On 8th of May, at Nike's headquarters, President Obama denounced opponents of the hotly contested Trans-Pacific Partnership as ill-informed. Quote from President Obama, "Critics warned that parts of this deal would undermine American regulation. They're making this stuff up. This is not, this is just not true. No trade agreement is going to force us to change our laws," end quote. Well, he's not true. That's an out-and-out lie. On May 18th, the World Trade Organization issued the final ruling in favor of Canada and Mexico in a case involving a U.S. law requiring country of origin labels on packages of beef, pork, chicken, and other kinds of meat. The three-judge World Trade Organization panel estimated economic damage at more than $3 billion. These would be meted out by Canada and Mexico as retaliatory tariffs on a potentially wide array of U.S. industries, from, quote, California wines to Minnesota mattresses, as Jerry Ritz, Canada's Minister of Agriculture, predicted. So, what about what Obama said? It's wrong. Obama's false claim exposed in real time. Quote, "The only way the United States to avoid billions in immediate retaliation is to repeal the COOL, C-O-O-L, Ritz announced. Congress hastened to comply. The day the World Trade Organization issued its ruling, Representative Mike Conway, Republican of Texas, introduced legislation to overturn the COOL law. On June 10th, the House overwhelmingly passed the bill 300-131. The COOL decision is almost immediate legislation impacted, demonstrated in real time the inaccuracy of President Obama's comments. So, you have to understand the Trans-Pacific Partnership is about manufacturers being protected, industries being protected, but in the United States, the environment, human health, animal health, our welfare, not protected. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. Just to give you a little coming attraction, we're going to be having Nick Bryant on to talk about problems of pedophilia in high places that have been blocked and covered up for almost 40 years in the United Kingdom. And what about in the United States? The big scandal here that no media was allowed to touch. We'll touch it. Also, we have Richard Smith on the other failure of green capitalism, Dr. Mark Grossman on alternative health care for the eyes, and Jim Garrison on failures of higher education and new educational paradigm. Christopher Bear on why in the world would anyone want Trump? And then a special program on Haiti. Those are some of the topics coming up. But now let's go over to Yorkshire in the United Kingdom. We're standing by as Professor Brad Evans. I gave you his bio earlier. Let me just add that he is also, in addition to being a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Bristol School of Sociology, Politics, and International Studies, and founding director of the Histories of Violence Project, which researches the role and impact of violence and its many manifestations upon society and culture. And he was the co-director of the international acclaimed film, 10 Years of Terror. He also has been a fellow of the Committee on Global Thought at Columbia University, and his articles appear in The Guardian, Al Jazeera, Truthout, Counterpunch, and other independent media. He is the co-author of a very recent book, Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle. His website is historiesofviolence.com. Nice to have you with us today.
Nice to join you. Thanks for the very kind invite, and I'm looking forward to discussing, obviously, some complicated and challenging issues with you today.
Good. When we reflect back, even 20 or 30 years ago, on what was shown on television, in theaters, and in the news networks, the subjects and the images used to introduce violence have changed dramatically to what we are bombarded with throughout all media today. And furthermore, we seem to be worshiping violence more than ever. Places of violent acts become sacred places for pilgrimage, such as Ground Zero in Lower Manhattan. But what I find most disturbing is the constant assault by the media and news of violent content. For younger generations who did experience the positive imagery of a constructive future, they are growing up in a world where violence is the norm, as if in a dystopian science fiction novel. That becomes their reality, and they are supposed to simply endure it because the media and the government as well reinforces the message that it won't change. And a child today is born into the world and is educated to accept that insecurity is the norm because violence is being accepted as a fact of life without an alternative. So I'd like you to address the state of modern culture today. Is the violent nature of our society, the perpetual war on terror, and the images of terrorists or even enemy combatants around every corner based upon a designed agenda, or does it reflect the reality of the world we live in today and how much of these images of our violent culture are fabricated by intention? The forum is yours.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to begin maybe just thinking about change in nature of, I think you're right in terms of, you know, one of the most difficult and challenging things that we encounter today is precisely the normalization of violence and how societies have kind of been a witness to the proliferation of different forms of violence. But I do think it's also worth bearing in mind that through this normalization of violence, what we also do experience within the media in particular is what we call in the book the aesthetic regime of mediated suffering. Now, what I mean by that is that whilst there has been, I guess, a proliferation of different representations of violence, certainly in the media, it's still very highly policed and regulated. And to give you three but evident examples, you know, if we look at the representations of violence which occurred in the immediate aftermath of 9/11, pretty much every single newspaper the day after in the dominant media all followed with images of exploding towers, which In that sense, it might have been quite inevitable. But what we, of course, find with those images is that the images actually function politically. And because the images of exploding towers look very much like warfare. Now, had they, of course, have chosen to have gone with Richard Drew's now infamous Fallen Man image, maybe the narrative which would have come out of it would have been very different, because the Fallen Man narrative immediately focuses on the human stakes to the tragedy and the human stakes to the conflict. And that in itself is one but evident example. Another example which we find in terms of contemporary representations of violence today is the discourse around the migrant. And we find this very much in Europe, how whilst that is a representation of the image of the migrant in Europe and the suffering and hardship they endure, they are still very much focused on the so-called security agenda. And in many senses, the violence which the migrant really suffers is kind of hidden in plain sight from us. Another, I guess, way we can kind of think about this as well in terms of the way that is this policing of representations of violence in the media is the way in which image and representation is matched by a particular type of discourse. Now, we find this very much in the case, and what's particularly striking being in the United Kingdom recently is within the mainstream sort of corporate media, the almost lack of attention really to the racial violence which is currently occurring in the United States of America. And it's quite striking if you do just a simple comparison between the way the UK media dealt with the Charleston church shootings as opposed to the beach killings in Tunisia. And one was the former was given, you know, some attention, but it was invariably reduced, as always, to, you know, the pathology of a lone attacker. Whereas in the subsequent case, there was, you know, once again, a civilization and a religion and an entire people are put on trial. And I think this is very much a recurring sort of thing that we find. Now, this What you point to also is, you know, there's a number of things which your opening discussion kind of pointed to, and I think each of them are kind of worth developing upon. I think you're right. You talked about the term dystopian, and again, we talk about this in the final chapter of the book, because I think what we've encountered, certainly in the decade post 9/11, is precisely the normalization of the politics of catastrophe. And that normalization of the politics of catastrophe now, as you rightly point out, forces us to accept that our societies are fundamentally insecure by design. And this, of course, is a profound shift in almost 200 years of political thinking, because we were taught to base the very idea of modern societies on what was called the security imperative. What was the state there for, after all, if it wasn't to provide security for its citizens? And, of course, out of which the social contract emerges. Now, this idea now that we find that societies are fundamentally insecure by design kind of naturalizes vulnerability. And I think one of the most telling outcomes of this has been the doctrine of resilience, which now demands that basically subjects just are forced to endure catastrophes, that there is actually no escape from the inevitability of catastrophe. And that in itself points to, I think, you know, what we mentioned in the book, the age of dystopian realism. And every war produces its casualties, but if we look at the wars on terror, there's been perhaps no greater casualties of the war on terror than the intellectual casualties, and that is precisely the idea that we can transform the world for the better.
I appreciate those insights. Thank you. What interests me in particular is how violence is used to promote political interest. Certainly this was fundamental to the entire propaganda machine during the Bush administration, and now the Obama administration has continued it. But when you look at the drones, all of the evidence suggests that there are over 5,000 innocent civilians killed, that 93% of the people in every drone attack are innocent civilians. And recently I watched a movie, a little art movie, with Ethan Hawke that dealt with him being a pilot in Las Vegas in one of these Air Force hangars, where he sits with four other people in a little cubicle and looks at a plane that he's piloting over the country of Afghanistan, and makes decisions about to kill people. And the interesting part of the film was that clearly they were killing people that had no bearing upon American security. They were killing innocent people, and this was by intent. And it finally dawned on him, you know, I can't kill any more innocent people, but everyone else around him could. And so he finally just left, and it didn't make any sensation. It was a small little tiny film. And I'm wondering how many people realize that when they had the power to kill, do they ever look in the eyes of the people who are going to die because they've been given that power? And the politicians in Washington, the President of the United States, who has a mandate to kill, does so with virtual impunity. They're responsible to no one. They control the laws. They have secret courts. And they win in every case because you're not allowed to present evidence. But this also creates an element of terror, where the government is an agent of terror. We fear our government because we see our government has become a police state, and we fear being trapped in it. And as a result, it impacts a lot of what the news media will and will not cover, and how far a person will go in showing their constitutional rights to protest. I would like for you to address the uses of power as political instruments to also create a sense that violence is going to come your way if you in any way challenge the government's violence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, again, dealing with a couple of the points that you raised there, first of all, I think there's a wonderful, you know, obviously, a famous book written by sociologist Zygmunt Bauman in his analysis of the Holocaust, and he basically said that, you know, the more you actually distance people from the act of killing, the easier it becomes sometimes. And that, of course, is what makes a genocide possible. Now, in terms of the advent of drone technologies, as you rightly point out, what the favoured method, it seems, for killing people today is assassination. And modes of assassination which seem to remarkably operate within the remit of law. even though it's sometimes presented and critiqued by some as outside of law, it operates, and law can kind of justify this use of this violence, even though it should be patently intolerable for people, because as you rightly point out, many of the casualties are innocent civilians. Now, linking this to the question, of course, of the domestic arena, and I think, and this is perhaps where, you know, the logic of terror gets logically inverted. I think one of the things we do need to kind of bear in mind, and this was, I guess, kind of slowly maturing in the decade before 9/11, but certainly has been accelerated in the aftermath of 9/11, is that the way we, even governments, understand warfare today is not the same as it was in the 20th century. And what we've encountered is a fundamental blurring of all the old modern demarcations between times of war, times of peace. What's the homeland? Where's the overseas theatres of war? Who are friends? Who are enemies? And of course, you know, this has had pernicious consequences in terms of the merging between military and development workers, for instance. But of course, in the homeland, there's a veritable merging between police and the military, where the lines between the two are pretty much almost impossible to differentiate, as was, of course, patently evident in the recent sort of uprisings in Baltimore. So once we understand how policing itself has been transformed within a war paradigm, we then get a different understanding of the ways in which these technologies function. And I think the drone technologies, you know, it's worth remembering your Anna Arendt's, the famous political philosopher's observation that, you know, what she called the colonial boomerang, and the technologies we actually deploy overseas will eventually come back home to us and be normalized in the domestic sphere. And the drone technology is one but of the obvious example of this, because, you know, and it won't be long, I'm assured, before, you know, we have a domestic killing by a drone technology. And this raises a whole number of difficult and challenging questions for us, because who, as you rightly point out in your mediation, who has the authority to sanction the kill? And where is the juridical recourse for this when the distancing is literally some guy operating in a warehouse? And I think that raises, you know, questions. And of course, technology always seems to outrun our ethical considerations in this case. There is also another, I guess, perhaps interesting point which I'd like to address with, you know, first of all, you know, the ways in which actually violence is becoming normalized globally, and this almost collapse between, you know, the overseas theaters of war today and the domestic theater, and the way that was accelerated 9/11. The increase in militarization of, you know, police forces is now well documented, and, you know, we should be clearly aware of that. But I'm also think it's worth looking at the much broader picture and the ways in which the different forms of technology also provide us with a particular diagnostic of political logics and political rules. And one thing which I think the drone technologies, and it's something which I've started to write about, seem to point to, actually, is part of this broader narrative of our shift towards dystopia and this idea that we can transform the world for the better, because the replacing by soldiers on the ground in overseas theatres of war by drone technologies coincides in many ways with almost our, you know, our retreat from the world of people and our retreat from the understanding and the retreat. And it's not only drones, of course, which have been deployed by military personnel, but also by development workers and aid workers and so forth as well, and replacing people on the ground. And I think that shift towards you know, this retreat from the world of people has been foreseen by many critics of technology for some considerable time, but it certainly points to new modalities of violence for which we seemingly don't have the forum in which to discuss the ethical and political consequences as yet.
One final thought, please, because we're coming to the end of our program. What role do you observe the war on terror has played upon the psyche of our nation and contributed to what I believe you call terror normality? And in particular, please address how the government, through the media, benefits by constantly reminding us of the violence associated with terrorists or extremists.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the term I used, terror normality, was in many ways a response, first of all, to a lot of the concerns I had with much of the discourse which appeared post 9/11. And it was too easy, I thought, to present, first of all, the violence of 9/11 has been some exceptional event, and in particular, to, you know, to say that the response by the Bush and Blair regimes was an exceptional abuse of power. The way those regimes operated, I actually thought was business as usual, and it was actually altogether expected. having a peaceful response to the violence of 9/11 would have been a truly exceptional politics, but it was all too apparent and all too expected. Now, what of course we found in the, you know, the shift in the post 9/11 terrain is the ways in which all manners of threat are now connected in one way or another. And the way the government and media narrates everything from earthquakes and hurricanes to terrorist attacks to potential viruses, it's all part of this new, what I've called in my work, the catastrophic topography of endangerment, where terror appears everywhere and it appears ubiquitous. Now, in that sense, of course, we can become almost guilty of producing the very future that we seem to desire. And perhaps nowhere is this more apparent than with the violence, of course, with the wars on terror, and the way in which that has actually been complicit in terms of the production of the very problems we face today, not least, of course, the problem of ISIS. And I think, you know, that there was a remarkably insightful piece written by John Pilger when he compares the problem of ISIS to the Khmer Rouge in Cambodia. And as Pilger pointed out, you know, Cambodia had no strategic interest in the latter part of the 1960s, and yet the United States government still dropped the equivalent of 5 Hiroshima bombs on a peaceful country. Well, in a matter of a couple of years, you have the emergence of a group of young radical men, very puritanical, for whom violence is their raison d'etre. And of course, they are just mimicking the system for whom violence is also the raison d'etre. And I think the parallels between ISIS and the Khmer Rouge are all too apparent for anybody who studied the violence and the tragedies of Iraq and Afghanistan. And I think where this, of course, leaves us is in a terrifying predicament, because it's not the case that you cannot do anything against this type of organization, but certainly it benefits the security state if we are constantly thrown into a condition of perpetual anxiety and violence, for which there seems to be no practical escape. And I think for us, the greatest challenge we therefore face today is to try to resurrect an alternative political imaginary such that violence is not normalized and such that we can think of more peaceful and, you know, futures for the world of people.
I would agree with that. Thank you very much, Professor Brad Evans, for the good work. Disposable Futures, The Seduction of Violence in the Age of Spectacle, co-written with Henry Giroux, someone who we have a lot of respect for and have had on the program. The website is historiesofviolence.com. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. Thank you for listening. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day.
Say it's all right.
It's all right.